It's Tuesday, August 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Turkey's increasing threat from Islamic State.
There are opportunities as well as threats, but certainly this is something that they can't afford to be complacent about at all.
European leaders meet to help preserve the EU. Also ahead, massive flooding in Louisiana. Donald Trump revisits his controversial immigration policy. And a summer camp for Broadway. It's all on today's International Edition. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Sunday said a young person, perhaps only 12 years of age, was the suicide bomber that killed more than 50 people and wounded dozens at a wedding ceremony in southern Turkey. He says it was likely the work of the Islamic State, although there has been no initial claim of responsibility. This latest attack comes just 5 weeks after a failed military coup that the Turkish government blamed on supporters of exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen. Regional analyst Ian Lustig of the University of Pennsylvania says if this was an Islamic State-inspired attack, it may be in retaliation for gains made on the battlefield by Kurdish fighters in Syria.
Since there have been setbacks for ISIS in Syria as a result of Kurdish fighters gaining territory from ISIS, Kurdish forces that are supported by the United States and have had the ability to move across the Turkish border, it's hard to believe they have direct support from Erdogan since he's conducting a war against the Kurds with his other hand. But ISIS appears to think that the Turks could stop the Kurds from fighting them in Syria, and they're not. So I think ISIS is attacking Turkey to try to get Turkey to crush the Kurds and also to warn Turkey not to become involved in the Syrian civil war in a way that would threaten ISIS. It's happening against the background of the Erdogan government conducting a purge of its own movement. Its movement, an Islamic movement that has taken power and ruled Turkey more or less democratically, but in recent years less and less democratically, came to power in part because of an alliance with this movement that is called the Gulen movement. Gulen is a preacher who now lives in self-imposed exile in the United States. He was originally a strong ally of Erdogan, and his whole movement, which includes economic and business and social ties and networks of people in the educational system, in the military, all of these groups are groups that Erdogan decided he no longer wanted to be in a position to rival him. What Erdogan has done is he's told the Turks something very hard to understand, that ISIS, the Kurds, and the Gulenists are all the same. They're enemies of Turkey. I do think that ISIS is on the downslide. They are suffering now. It reverses. But that doesn't mean that they can't lash out in extremely destructive ways, as they showed with this last attack. I am expecting more violence, and I think more violence from more quarters, including those who will sympathize with the tens of thousands of Turkish civil servants and military officers who are now being imprisoned. Erdogan released over 30,000 prisoners just to make room for all those he's been purging from the upper ranks of Turkish civil society. This is very hard to predict where this is going to end.
Regional analyst Ian Lustig of the University of Pennsylvania. It's time for us now to check out what's buzzing online. Our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, is here in the studio to do just that. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Well, it looks like swimmer Ryan Lochte's week did not quite start off on the right note.
Well, doesn't it? Lochte lost a number of sponsorships after distorting a story about him vandalizing a gas station in Brazil to turn the blame to the locals. Speedo speedily dropped him. The UK-based swimwear manufacturer announced a decision on both Twitter and Facebook, and this is part of the announcement. We cannot condone behavior that is counter to the values this brand has long stood for. The company plans to donate $50,000 from Lochte's fee to a children's charity in Brazil. And after the announcement, many social media users urged the American fashion house Ralph Lauren to follow suit, and it did.
Wow. Well, any news on the political front?
There always is. It's a gift that keeps on giving,
yes,
or at least until the election day. GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump sent out two tweets targeting the left-leaning station MSNBC. He tweeted, "Tried watching low-rated @morning_Joe this morning. Unwatchable. @morningMika is off the wall, an erotic and not very bright mess." He is referring to one of the hosts for the show, Mika Brzezinski. Trump also insinuated a romantic relationship between the two hosts, Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough. Scarborough replied, "Thanks for watching. Morning Joe is enjoying its best ratings ever thanks to obsessed fans like you. Glad," and he topped it off with a smiley face.
Well, we'll have more of Mr. Trump in International Edition in a little bit, but anything else trending?
Another politics story, but this time involving Hillary Clinton. Conservative watchdog organization Judicial Watch claimed Bahrain's Crown Prince tried to meet her through the Clinton Foundation. It released a 2009 email allegedly from Clinton aide Huma Abedin to a foundation employee to set up a meeting for Salman bin Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa, who gave a $100,000 donation. And critics argued online that this shows she will have too many quote-unquote obligations to past donors. Jim, back to you.
Well, quite a busy day online. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. You may tweet us your comments and questions to @VOA_IE. That is our International Edition Twitter stream. And you'll find myself and G on Twitter as well, @VOA Stevenson and @GAbbyLee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, the United Nations says North Korea is appeared to resume plutonium production this year. U.S.-South Korea begin annual military drill despite threats from Pyongyang. Afghan and India leaders vow to deepen cooperation in fighting terrorism. Japanese Prime Minister Abe wows Rio finale as Super Mario. And Pyeongchang Olympics working to avoid Rio mishaps. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on our website, voanews.com. And if you have a smartphone, check out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The leaders of the so-called Big Three of the European Union, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President François Hollande, and host Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, have met Monday off of the Italian coast to discuss ways to keep the European project on track in the wake of Britain's June referendum to leave the 28-nation bloc and rising Euroscepticism. This second meeting, following the first in Berlin, is seen as preparatory for an EU-wide summit in Bratislava on the post-Brexit way forward next month. The meeting took place as some of the EU's remaining 27 members, including the Netherlands, resist even closer integration. In Australia, Monash University European analyst Ben Wellings tells VOA's Victor Beattie, Brexit is viewed by some European leaders as having the potential to disrupt or even derail the European project.
It also has the potential to enliven it and bring it closer to the people, maybe make it less contentious. So there are opportunities as well as threats. But certainly this is something that they can't afford to be complacent about at all.
Ben, how likely is a referendum in some of these other EU countries like the Netherlands?
Well, I think it would be resisted very hard. Referendums, of course, are not a popular tool of European leaders or status quo European leaders ever since the 2005 referendum went against the draft constitutional treaty in France and the Netherlands. Places like the Netherlands and France do have this kind of groundswell of Eurosceptic opinion, so I think that they would be avoided. And you remember this time last year in 2015, the Greek people voted against accepting a bailout package and it was forced on them anyway. So I think that there would be considerable pressure not to hold another referendum yet again. The question is, whether that will then increase the pressure for it because it will be seen as a denial of a democratic right. So status quo leaders will want to remain in control of the process by holding off the idea of another referendum.
Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has called for a referendum on October 2nd.
He has, and of course he's not a status quo leader at all, and this is one of the areas where those people around Hollande, Merkel and Renzi may lose control of the process. Renzi himself is embroiled in a referendum of his own choosing about constitutional reform in Italy, nothing to do with the EU, which may go against him, and he may lose that and he may step down. So Orban is calling for a referendum in order to put pressure on the whole migration deal that the Commission has been trying to sort out since last August. So these are the way that now referendums have tended to be used by peoples or politicians or parties that want to challenge the EU's status quo and to disrupt things, just in the way that Syriza did to no effect, of course, in the bailout package agreements last year. So they will pop up. In some ways, the French presidential election next year in May, if Le Pen gets into that, will be in some ways a referendum about France's future in the EU. So definitely the pressure is out there. But those people who want to retain control of the process around the new big three, France, Germany and Italy, will resist this.
Germany also faces a general election next year, while Mr. Renzi has staked his political future on an Italian constitution referendum critics say will further centralize political power. The Prime Minister has indicated he could resign if that fails. Parts of the Baton Rouge, Louisiana area are getting thunderstorms with heavy rain as people continue cleaning out homes to recover from recent catastrophic flooding. About 3,200 people remain in shelters. International Edition's Lori London spoke with Mike Steele. He's a spokesman for the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness and asked how many people have been impacted by last week's flooding.
The registration count's already up to 102,000. So technically, if that was all done properly, that's one person per household. Mm. So it's hard for us to determine exactly how many people are in each household. But, you know, there's quite a few.
It sounds pretty catastrophic from what we're hearing as far as people literally being displaced.
It is pretty devastating. I was a television reporter when Katrina and Rita hit, and I thought that was about as bad as it could get. This looks very similar in some areas to Katrina. And so, you know, that's kind of the same comments you hear from a lot of people as they go around and look at some of the areas. I personally live in Livingston Parish, which was one of the hardest hit areas. And kind of being in the Denham Springs area and some of the areas in Livingston Parish reminded me a lot of being in some of the places right outside of New Orleans after Katrina.
What does it look like?
Just total, you know, devastation. There's piles of debris everywhere as people try to, you know, got everything out of their homes to help with the mold fight and to get everything cleaned out properly. And then, you know, a lot of the major shopping centers in Denham Springs are completely shut down. There's a large home improvement store right off the interstate, and they're talking about running operations out of the parking lot just to help people with things like sheetrock and lumber and different things they may need, because they estimate it could be 6 or 8 weeks before that store gets reopened. But there's a couple of other newer, you know, brand new major shopping centers that are completely shut down right now.
Any idea how long it will take to recover from something like this?
It's going to be months. And you know, it's hard to tell exactly. You still have standing water in some areas right now. And luckily, those are some areas that, you know, with a smaller population. But, you know, it's still just as devastating to those people. But, you know, we're definitely talking about a long recovery process here. So, you know, we're trying to make sure we keep everybody focused. One of the things we were fortunate to have was that literally as the rain was still falling, FEMA already had some key people on the ground with us. So they were able to go out and take some early, like, you know, they were getting a look at some of these areas that were obviously devastated by these floods. And so we were able to get the presidential declaration very early. So that was kind of key to us. And even though it was only four parishes to begin with, anybody in the state that was impacted by this could start that registration process.
I understand the forecast is calling for more rain. How concerned is your agency about that?
Well, we've had rain almost every afternoon since the flooding stopped. So that definitely adds a few more challenges onto what we're doing. This is a time of year when you see a lot of pop-up thunderstorms. start to hit the state. We have the threat of tropical weather that we're still, keeping an eye on. And as a matter of fact, the governor's already made all of the key agencies start having meetings on, okay, what if we're dealing with this and we have to start dealing with the threat of a tropical system? Like, how are we going to address it? So those conversations have already started. And, there's no guarantee that you couldn't have another very large event. We have thunderstorms here can cause, severe damage at times. We pretty much have to stay ready for anything. And then there's a number of industrial sites, all over the state, especially South Louisiana. And so, you could always have some type of new problem, compound the current problem.
Mike Steele, spokesman for the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump says he is holding firm in his views to deport 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States, one of his main campaign planks in the November election against Democrat Hillary Clinton. Although his new campaign manager has said Trump's deportation plans were to be determined. Trump's tough talk on illegal immigrants and the stream of undocumented migrants entering the country helped fuel his run to the Republican presidential nomination. But he is badly trailing Clinton among minority voters, according to national political surveys. In the past few days, he's been making a new pitch to court's support among African Americans and Hispanics. VOA's Ken Breitemeyer talks about Trump's undocumented immigrant plan with International Edition's Sarah Williams.
This morning, however, he said, I'm not flip-flopping. He's not flip-flopping in the sense that he is still holding on to the idea of deporting the 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. Now, whether he actually changes the policy in the coming days, that's certainly who knows. But he's holding firm. And the reason this issue came up is that his new campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, when asked about the same issue just a day ago, said, to be determined. So Trump was left to try to explain, well, what is to be determined? And he said, I'm not flip-flopping. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, it seems that Ms. Conway is, she's publicly coming forward with this. I think it seems like she's trying to indicate that since she assumed command of the campaign, that, there's somewhat of a change or sort of a more muted response by Mr. Trump.
She certainly is trying to make her chosen candidate. She did work for somebody else in the Republican primaries, but she's now with Trump. And she, in her mission, obviously, is to make him as acceptable to as many millions of voters as she can. And Trump trails in the polls. He has to do better and make himself more acceptable to the masses, not just the people who handed him the Republican nomination.
VOA's Ken Breitemeyer. You'll find more on this story on our website, voanews.com. Follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Summer camp between the school year is a ritual for many American kids, and there's a unique camp right here in the Washington area that offers an opportunity to some aspiring teenage artists to get a taste of what it takes to make it onto Broadway. VOA's Jun So has more on Young Artists of America's Musical Theater Intensive Summer Camp in this report narrated by Carol Pearson.
I want to make magic. I want to be bigger than I am.
Ari Goldbloom-Helsner is rehearsing the lead role in the stage musical based on the 1980 film Fame. He's one of 39 teenagers participating in a musical theater program that runs from 8 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. During the day, the students take dancing, acting, and singing classes. And in the evening, they apply everything they've learned to the actual production.
Very intensive, and I think that's the part that's most exhausting, but also the part that I most love.
The overnight camp program is run by the Young Artists of America. Opera singer Rolando Sanz co-founded the organization, which also offers programs during the school year.
We're entering our sixth year. What I love about this program and what it's becoming is that we're attracting the kids that really want to excel and to be around other kids like them.
The participants learn skills and techniques from professional artists and mentors, and they spend every waking moment preparing for the production. Amanda Yuan has the female lead role.
I'm really tired, but it is so great. I mean, I'm not only having a lot of fun, but I feel like I'm really improving myself and I'm really working myself and pushing myself to the limit. And I'm constantly overcoming challenges and obstacles, which is a great feeling at the end of the day.
I've really felt like I've improved my craft with Young Artists of America. And this camp really has helped me do that as well and continue that journey. And I hopefully take those skills and continue that journey in college and beyond.
At the end of the two-week-long summer program, the aspiring artists showcase their talent and skills at a local theater. Sanz says some students will continue to shoot for the stars, but all of them will support and appreciate performing arts throughout their lives. For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And as always, we thank you for listening to International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The skies of North America today provide the backdrop for celebrating a century of conservation of one of Earth's most treasured animals, migratory birds. On August 16, 1916, the United States and Great Britain, on behalf of Canada, signed the first migratory bird treaty to protect these shared natural resources. The treaty was the first international agreement forged to protect wild birds and among the first to protect any wildlife species. The Migratory Bird Treaty is the foundation for significant achievements in bird conservation that followed, with both nations enacting statutes to implement its provisions. In 1917, the Canadian Parliament passed the Migratory Bird Convention Act. In 1918, the U.S. Congress followed suit, passing the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. In subsequent years, the United States signed similar treaties with Mexico, Japan, and Russia. Our two countries' conservation efforts have yielded real results, especially for waterfowl populations, said Catherine McKenna, Canadian Minister of Environment and Climate Change. I am proud of the work we have done, but as the recent release of the State of North America's Birds Report has shown, we have a challenging road ahead. I know we are up to the task, and I look forward to building on our successes together to recover other migratory bird species. It's hard to imagine the North American continent without egrets, ducks, hawks, or songbirds. But at the turn of the 20th century, that's the way things were looking, said Dan Ash, director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which has responsibility for conserving and managing migratory birds and their habitats. This treaty marked a turning point in the fate of our shared bird life, and it continues to this day to unite efforts in the United States and Canada to protect birds across our international boundaries.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.